and welcome to the Story Fusion podcast. As usual, we are your hosts,
Doro
and Philip. Doro, are you a vegetarian?
Actually, no, still not yet. But after reading the book, when I went to the supermarket last time, I bought some seitan stuff because I couldn't stand to buy meat.
Yeah, that's better than me, because I'm still eating meat without regret. That's, well, not very ethical of me, I know, but still. And the book hasn't changed anything about that. I'm probably not Korean enough.
Well, the book we're talking about today is The Vegetarian by Han Kang. It was published originally in South Korea in 2007 and was translated to English by Deborah Smith in 2015, I think, right?
Yeah,
so
like
several
that.
Years later. Last year it was also translated to German, and in English-speaking countries it became famous because it won the Man Booker International Prize. More about the translation later on. Let's jump to the story. So basically, the story, which is told in three different parts, told by different narrators, is about a woman who turns vegetarian. And she's not only becoming a vegetarian, she wishes to transform herself into a tree, which is basically the end of the story. And the three parts, as mentioned before, are told by different people, and more on the details by Philip now.
Yeah. The first part is told by her husband. It's told in the first person, from a first person view. And it, it begins with the husband basically telling, I never paid much attention to my wife until the day she turned vegetarian.
Very strong beginning, I think.
Yeah. And this is at the beginning, the husband tolerates her. Well, he thinks it's just a phase or something. But it turns out that she is very serious about this. She's throwing everything away that has to do with meat or animal products. And he is very, he describes that she has never been so, well, sensitive about these matters in the past. But still, the first time when he notices that is something really odd is when he's going to a dinner with her and colleagues, where nobody really understands what her problem is, basically, or what she has. And whenever she's being asked about it, she just says she had a dream. That dream is vaguely described in the only passages in the book which are written from her perspective. They are rather short, usually shorter than one page, and are very surreal in a certain way. And this first part basically turns into, comes to a head when she and her husband are visiting, having a big meal with her family. And it turns out that her father is a very strong-minded man, to put it that way. He fought in the war, exactly. And he is trying to force his daughter to eat meat, physically forcing her to. And this ends with her attempting to commit suicide right in front of her family with a knife. And this is where the first part ends, basically. And the second part is written from the perspective of her brother-in-law, who is an artist, and it's written in the third person. And he is an artist who hasn't really had much success in the past. He's stuck in a certain... He has an artist's block. He hasn't really created much in these days. And he is... his wife is basically the one who is... keeping the family afloat, because she has is a manager in a perfume store, I think.
It's a cosmetic store. It's her own,
yeah,
I think. She built
right.
that up.
And he describes that the incident with his sister-in-law, with a vegetarian, was happened a few months ago, I think, or something. Was
it might be even a year, because she was hospitalized after...
Right, exactly. She was hospitalized. It was about a year ago, but he says his life has been transformed because he has seen this kind of change, this life and death situation has changed him. And from his wife, he gets the information that his sister-in-law has a Mongolian mark, that's a birthmark in the lower region and close to the bottom. And somehow he develops an obsession with this Mongolian mark, and he gets the idea that he wants to paint on his sister-in-law. He wants to cover her in flowers and shoot that as a movie. And this turns very quickly turns sexual. He has very sexual desires towards her. And he tries to convince her to do this movie with him. And she is, she has returned from the mental hospital where she had been for a while and has a small apartment and is basically trying to get her life back on track. When he approaches her and she is strangely passive, he doesn't really know what to do with her. But when he asks her if she would partake in this, well, artist thing.
Video shooting.
Yeah, video shooting. She agrees. But this shooting basically begins to escalate because the simply painting flowers on her is not enough. He's convinced that she has to have sex in front of the camera. And first he asks a colleague of his, who is named Jay in the book, to do that when the young man is not convinced, when he thinks this goes too far. He's the one who decides that he has to have sex with her himself. And this is when the second part basically ends, because his wife has found out. She comes into the apartment where the apartment of the vegetarian, when they've just finished shooting the picture.
Yeah, the second video.
Yeah, second video, right, which he wants to cut into one big thing. And he attempts to commit, the brother-in-law attempts to commit suicide. He wants to jump off the veranda or the balcony. But he stopped right in time. And this is where the second part ends. And the third part begins is now written from the perspective of the sister. So the wife of the artist from the second part. It's now, I think, several years after the incident.
Yeah, I don't know how many, but years later.
Yeah, years later. And the vegetarian is in a mental hospital now. And her sister drives there with a bus to visit her. It's somewhere outside of Seoul in South Korea. And basically the whole part is a long description of what happens. It could be one afternoon. It's not really clear how much time passes, but it's all a very clear sequence of events which takes place there. As she arrives there in the hospital, she finds out that her sister has decided not to eat anything anymore, and she has, after she had been fled to a forest and had been away from the mental hospital for a while, and she was caught again and brought back to the mental hospital. But after that, she refused to eat because she is convinced that she is a tree now. And she stands on her head all the time because she thinks that, her head is basically, and her hair are the roots, and her tree, her feet are basically, the upper side of the tree. And she is in a critical condition because she has, her refusal to eat anything has means that she is anorexic. She is very is close to, lose consciousness because she hasn't eaten so. And they try to force feed her in the hospital, and this goes extremely bad. She has internal bleedings, when they try to do that, and she has to be brought into a normal hospital. And the story basically ends with her sister riding in the ambulance with the vegetarian. It's a very dark story, if you haven't noticed yet.
So the three parts are named The Vegetarian, Mongolian Mark, and The Flaming Trees, which maybe already hints something on the genre, the different of the three parts.
And we should mention that they were first published as three three novellas before they were published as a whole book, as a novel. So it was,
And I think if you read them together, you can read that from the perspective of the vegetarian, the protagonist who hasn't got her own voice, more or less. You can read it like a three-act drama, a tragedy, in the three parts. And how would you characterize the three different novellas as genre?
It's a little bit difficult, but I think that Han Khan, the writer, is deliberately placing them in very rather established genres of at least literary fiction. The first one is what I always call confession literature, because it's written from the first person perspective, and you have things like, which is probably the best known example of that kind of confession literature, is Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov, which is written from the perspective of a sexual abuser who is abusing a child called Lolita in the book. And this is very strong in the first part, because we are really in the head of this husband, who is not, he is partly self-critical, but he is very much somebody who is tormenting her, which is also something that can often be seen in this kind of confession literature. The second part is pretty much, you mentioned the term of the genius, right? It's the artist, the artistic genius here, who is having an obsession with a woman, and he has to paint her in this book, he has to paint on her, and which is very common, I think, as a literary motive.
And also, like, he's tormented, he has to overcome he has to overcome his artistic block, as you mentioned already. So
and the third part is the one which I had the most problems with, because it was it's extremely realistic in a certain way, but at the same time it's has strange elements. For example, these flaming trees are being mentioned in one passage, and you have in another passage the sister-in-law remembers that her son has had a dream about her being a bird flying away and things like that. So it's partly surreal, but I think it's in a certain way it's a very much a tragedy or a melodrama, and I think it has strong motives of being a descent to hell, as I've called it, because it's when she gets there with the bus, she has to pass through a tunnel, and then there is this really secluded mental hospital at the bottom of a valley. You have several gatekeepers who are preventing her from going inside, and she has to bargain with them, and every step of the way is basically making things worse than before she finally, and when she is with her sister, she is already this kind of life and death situation, because her sister is so so emaciated and has so little, has gotten so little food in the last few days, that she's so weak and has to be force fed, and that is even making things even more worse. So these kind of things where I think it's also something that you can find as in novels very often, which is this slow escalation of events until everything is basically gloom and doom. you brought up the term that the reader is being manipulated when you, especially in, I think in the first part and the second part.
I think the second part is the strongest in the manipulation area, because it's more, maybe, yeah, it's more subtle than in the first part, because the first part, only on the first page, I think you believe the narrator, the first person narrator, her husband, that he really, that he might be honest, because yeah, he tells that, well, okay, and she even liked me when I got a paunch and I've got skinny legs and forearms, so he knows himself that he's not beautiful and everything, but still she's kind of a good wife. But then we learn good wife for him means she cooks for him,
yeah,
he can have sex with her sometimes, and that's, she doesn't
complain much,
and she doesn't complain much, yeah, she's not, until she turned vegetarian, she's completely unremarkable for him, and that's a good thing. I mean, we learn later on that he really works a lot, but even the kind of work he does is not really remarkable. So it's really like a not getting in the way of everything. And that gets disturbed by her becoming a vegetarian. So we soon learn that he's not reliable and that he's kind of an asshole. He kind of rapes her too. And
the, he really doesn't have any kind of connection with her. He
yes,
even says in several parts, it's being mentioned that he is rather confused by her suddenly being so complicated, yes, basically.
Yes, that's right. And it ends really on page 50. So the first part has 50 pages. It ends like, I don't know this woman. I don't know who this woman is. And I think that sums it up.
And then you have the second part with the artist, which is very interesting because it's written from a third person perspective, but you would say that the manipulation is even stronger in that one.
Absolutely, because what happens is you have this artist who even thinks about the husband of her and characterizes the husband as too vulgar for her, who too materialistic, basically not empathetic enough, and he feels a strong connection to the woman, to the vegetarian, because of this connection, like, he was the one, when she cut her wrists, he was the one who grabbed her and brought her to the hospital, and he even kept the shirt with her blood on it. So he feels this strong connection because he's also, he has a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
The family life, like every kind of family life that exists in this book, is rotten and exists more or less only on paper. It's like a management thing. Okay, we have the son together, so who's going home early to take care of the son? That's the kind of communication they have. There's no sex happening anymore, and I think you can read out that he has problems, so he's not aroused anymore by anything until he learns about the Mongolian mark, and then the obsession starts, and also combined with this sexual arousal thing, or his interests awakening again, his artistic drive
returns.
Yes. And I think it's more manipulative because he starts with, you think he understands her more.
Mm-hmm.
He has empathy for her, and basically what you learn between the lines is that he just uses her as protection for his own feelings and for his own personality. And in the end, he completely uses her. What you brought in was the literary figure of the femme fatale, speaking about protection.
I mean, this
and the male gaze and everything.
I mean, you have the, on the one hand, you have, of course, this kind of the artistic muse, right? I mean, she is supposed to be something like a literary muse for him. But also, you have at the same time this femme fatale thing, where is the woman you love is going to doom you, basically, and is going to drag you to hell, basically. And this is also something that he is very much present here, because he is putting his marriage in jeopardy. He is trying to manipulate basically his wife and everybody around him to get what he wants.
Well, I think what happens here is this kind of animal side of the man that comes out because of the
drive.
The sexual drive, yeah. So he turns into an animal, basically, yeah, and he can't think anymore. And he even neglects his kid for her. So he turns completely crazy, basically.
Yes. And he is, well, he's close to commit suicide at the end. He doesn't succeed. But still, it's definitely there, this kind of motive of the femme fatale. And the interesting thing, though, is that she, the vegetarian, is very passive. She doesn't really do it. And this is important about this projection that you mentioned, that this is entirely in his head.
Yes.
And we don't know what the vegetarian actually thinks about that. And this is also something that he is very strong in this chapter with, which you already mentioned, with the male gaze, right? That he is seeing her as a sexual object that he, in a certain way, that he can use, that is there for him to be. Well,
I think yes and no, because maybe he lies about it, because for a long time he says, okay, she is just a body, rid of desire. She has transformed being not a sexual thing anymore. She's more vegetal. That's all he says about her.
Mm.
And at the same time, his arousal is always mentioned.
Yes.
So it happens basically at the same time. So he says about her, she's a body rid of desire. She got rid of this part of her, this human side of her. But for him, that totally awakens his sexual drive. So, but he doesn't connect that he's using her for his own or projecting stuff on her. And in this part, we have if we can trust him in that, is that she says to him, I want to have the flowers on me.
Yes.
So that's the only thing we learn about her, that she wants to have these flowers, and we even learn why she wants to have them on her body, that is, because they stop her dreams.
Yes. And this is actually, I think, one of the major tragic parts in the book, because in a certain way, this man who just uses her for his own pleasure is the one who finds a way for her to at least temporarily ease her condition.
Yeah.
He makes, for a moment, she is doing better, and then he fucks up everything, right? I mean, it's getting even worse afterwards.
Yeah.
That is because the situation in the end, when he has attempted to, after he attempted to commit suicide, she is being brought back to the mental hospital. And that is what is being covered in the last part of the book then, what happens there. So this is basically her, she had a second chance after she had already been committed, after the incidents with her husband, but now
who divorced her by the
time of the part two, and then she has a second chance, and this man comes into her life and makes these things even worse than they have been before,
and robs her from this freedom the flowers originally brought her.
And we have this kind of thing that we always see in basically all the male figures in a certain way. Here is this kind of lack of empathy, and this, they are emotionally stunted. They are emotionally underdeveloped. They are extremely egoistic at the entire time, and they only see the women around them on a purely, you know, utilitarian level. They don't have no emotional connection to them. They're just useful to attain certain goals, be it either sexual pleasure or, in the first part, the husband who just wants a mate, right? I mean, he wants a mate who's doing his meals for him.
Yes, and as we learn in the already in the first chapter, and then in the third, that starts with her father.
Yes, this is a very strong element of her, basically, of what we learn about the vegetarian in her life, that all the men who have been of importance in her life seem to have been abusive. And this is something especially that I noticed in one of the reviews that I read about the book, was it was written by a student paper for the Oxford University, which is might excuse certain why it's not so good, the review, at least in my eyes. But the interesting thing was that they wrote about, let me look this up, because it was so, they called this the second part an exploration of sensuality, and talked at length about how very erotic and this second part is, and I think that completely misses the point. There's also, of course, the kind of manipulation that you mentioned, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But the reviewer, I think, didn't really understand what the kind of relation between the artist and the vegetarian were.
Yeah, absolutely not.
And so in a certain way, the whole book is something like a victim story, right? I mean, and...
Yeah, please go on, because I...
You're already on the verge of contradicting me, so I don't want to... But, okay, let me adjust that. I think the idea that I just had when we talked about this is also that in a certain way, because she never is being... doesn't have a voice of her own, this is something that is very often something that is in common with victims, right? That we always complain that the perpetrators, they get a voice, they get to talk about why they did something, but the victims, they don't get a voice. They are sometimes they are dead, or they are at least not in an emotional state where they can freely talk about what happened to them. So in a certain way, this book is a very, let's say, radical in that regard, because actually it is telling the story of a victim, and it denies the victim a voice to talk for herself.
And the only voice she gets in her dreams makes her an offender on her own. Or that's like the reason why she becomes a vegetarian is because she thinks, well, I mean, that's a metaphor as well, but what she sees always, and that's why the dream is so bloody, is how she sees her face eating something like red meat, and it's just too much meat. She has a lump in her solar plexus that is built of too much meat. And I think in the last dream that is mentioned, or maybe that's an inner monologue, I'm not sure. She says something of no one can help her. It can't be undone. It happened already. She ate too much meat and that's it. And what we learn then later is that what she ate as a kid was a dog that bit her, and her father made her eat it.
Yeah.
And that's like the guilt she feels beginning as a child.
I think it is very much, you know, victims always, or very often, tend to internalize the abuse they have experienced in their lives. And so I think that you know, that is very much in line with her being a victim of abuse in a certain way. And of course, it's the abuse here in the book is on various different levels. You have this kind of emotional abuse. You have this kind of, the father being extremely violent towards her. It's also explained in the third part of the book that the other sisters, there were three sisters in the family, that the other sisters didn't have this kind of problem with the father, that she was the middle child and she never developed a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. So she is, in a certain way, very traumatized by the events of the past. And of course, that gets worse. I mean, the book states in the third part that she's suffering from schizophrenia, but that's just mentioned on the sidelines. It's not even made such a big deal out of, especially because in the first two parts, you don't even know what she is suffering from, or if it's just some kind of surreal malaise that has come down on her, and without being something that is actually a mental illness.
I think the feeling you get as a reader, how her social life is described by others that are not so reliable, but is her not really talking to people anymore and not even reacting. And also in the second part, the painter, her brother-in-law, says something about her eyes would seem to reflect a kind of violence that could not simply be dismissed as passivity or indifference, in which she would appear to be struggling to suppress. So, I mean, that's the motive of the eyes is always like, well, one hand the soul, and on the other it's like the projection field per se.
Yeah.
Where you project, like in the Sandman by E.T.L. Hoffman, where Nathaniel, the main protagonist, he projects everything in the eyes of a puppet, more or less. And this part and the use of the motif totally reminded me of that German romantic. It's also a novella, right?
It's a novella, yeah. Yeah.
So I lost my train of thought. I started reading out the good quote.
Maybe it's a good opportunity to talk about the motifs in the book, because especially you have encountered many of them. You said there were, of course, the trees, plants, the trees and plants motifs.
She starts by eating only plants and ends up with thinking she is a tree, and we learn that flowers help her suppress the violent dreams she has in the second part. And maybe like the animal plant connections and surrounding her, maybe you discovered the bird theme.
Yeah, I only noticed that there's a bird on the cover of the English edition until I realized that there is lots of birds showing up in the book as well, which I was thinking might be associated with some kind of soul theme. I'm not sure if that's a thing in South Korea, but I mean, in Western tradition, you have this kind of link between birds and souls, and birds being free and flying to the heavens to join, well, to go to paradise and stuff like that. And it's definitely something that shows up a lot with birds. You have this, you also have at the end of the first of part one, you have this incident where the vegetarian is she's already in the hospital after her suicide attempt, and she is it's not very clear if she has ripped off or bitten off, I think she has bitten off the head of a little bird that she caught.
I don't know if it's the head. I think what happens, and that's the reason why she stays in the hospital, is that she sits outside. She has freed her breasts, which she does often because she don't like bras. She hates the feeling of clothes. And she says also at another point that the only part of her body she likes are her breasts, because it's something that you can't kill with. So just another thing that I remembered right now. So, and she sits there, her upper body naked, and she has something in her fist, and then her husband comes to her and he opens the fist, and a small bird falls out of her hand. It's dead, it's maybe crumbled to death, but then he sees the bite marks of a predator
upon it.
And I mean, we just assumed that it's her that has bitten, in a rush of madness, has bitten the bird. And the super interesting thing then is, in the third part, narrated by her sister, that was something you stumbled upon.
This is the second to last passage, basically, in the book, where she's describing this, that her son has awakened her at night, I think, and her son is, I don't know, very young, and still a rather small child, and the son was very upset because he had a dream that his mother would transform into a white bird and fly away and leave him basically alone. Of course, that is just before that is while she remembers this sequence, this dream of her son's, while she is sitting in the ambulance and rides alongside her ill or sister.
So, I mean, it could be like a metaphor for either death or for freedom. Yes. So the son is afraid, the mother goes away, basically. What I find interesting is the link between the sisters, because I can't really put a finger on it, how their relationship really is, because the sister, for example, she doesn't really tries to stop the father hitting her. We learn more about their history as children, but it's not, for me, not clear. Is that a loving relationship? Is the sister too maybe somehow affected, but could cope better?
Well, she says at one point, she says that she had this kind of always, this drive that she knew always what she wanted to have in her life, and that it didn't, the abusive father didn't affect her as much as her younger sister. But still, you're right, the kind of relationship that the two sisters have is not really being explored. We just find out that at this point in the book that her sister is paying for everything. And I think there's also this, because you mentioned death, the death of the sister, there's also this kind of, I don't know if there are flashbacks, but the sister remembers having visited her sister before, when her sister was still speaking. At the end of the book, the sister's, the vegetarian, is not even speaking anymore. And the sister remembers that, I think her the vegetarian mentions in the past that there is a final stage, basically, where she doesn't need anything anymore but sunlight. And that this would be the final stage of her transformation into a tree. And of course, this is in this kind of situation already hints that her sister basically wants to die. At least it's something, the connection that I made when I read the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just, well, maybe the dream the sun has is then the symbol for the one person, maybe apart from the husband in the beginning, the one person she is really the one person who takes responsibility for others.
Yes, that's true.
And the sun is the one, maybe, who would also hinder her to fly away. So she wouldn't become a bird and fly away because she has to take care of the son and also her sister.
Yeah.
I mean, she got rid of her husband as well, I think.
They divorced.
Yeah, they divorced too.
Yeah. I think this last passage I already mentioned, that is, it strongly reminded me of a South Korean movie by Chan Wook Park. I'm a cyborg, but that's okay. I don't know if there is some kind of a link between the novel The Vegetarian and this movie, because they came out roughly at the same time.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think the movie was in 2005 or something, so it's really close. But what's interesting is that in the movie, it's about a young woman who is sent to a mental hospital because she is not eating anymore. And in this book, she is convinced that she is a cyborg, and also that she needs is electricity. So she is licking batteries all the time.
Yeah, I remember.
And this is basically the central, well, let's say, conflict of the entire movie. It's a very, I have to say, it's a comedy. It's completely unlike the book in any scene, except that they share this element of a woman who thinks she is something else and basically starves herself. And I don't have so much experience with South Korean literature, but I think there are, in South Korean cinema, or at least of what I know of, there are some traditions that seem to be present in the book as well, or they have the kind of same background there. I had also think a little bit of Kim Ki-duk, who is a South Korean director who has made movies who are extremely violent in a certain way. They have this not always on a visual or physical level, but also very emotional level, where the characters are very extreme. He has made movies such as, I think it's just called Samaritan, and one of them is called The Lake, I think, is another one from his. The Lake is also it's also a movie about food and violence. So it seems to be something that might be a common topic in South Korean culture. But I don't know where it's coming from. It's a little bit strange, of course, to read a book from a different country and not know anything about that.
And I mean, what you also read is that the translation, I mean, speaking of different languages, also played an important role, maybe that the book won the prize it won?
Yeah, that's an interesting story, because there was, let's not call it a minor scandal, but something close to it surrounding this book, because this was the book, Deborah Smith, right? It's a translator. She was studying at Oxford or something, and she was basically just finishing her studies in this for South Korean language and culture. And basically the first thing that she did was translate this book, because it impressed her so much. And she went with this translated book, she went to the publisher, and the publisher was absolutely enthusiastic about it and instantly published it, and it won the Man Booker Prize. And when it did, South Korean, well, the literary scene of South Korea got aware of this, that it was making waves in outside of South Korea. And the odd thing was that they noticed that the translation is rather off, that is not really very close to the original. The language, especially of the original, seems to be very sparse, extremely minimal in a certain way. And what the translation, the English translation, added was lots of flowery terms and more adjectives and stuff like that. So it reads really differently. The story is still the same. It's still exactly the same story. I read a paper by a South Korean, well, he was working as a professor at a Western university. He had to be South Korean, at least judging by name. And he said in his article that he doesn't really think it's a bad translation. He think it's a good adaptation of the original novel. And he thinks it's, of course, also responsible why the book was so successful, even though it isn't anything like the, or at least not very close to the original book. Unfortunately, we didn't have the time to read the German edition.
Which is supposed to be being closer to the original. Well, we don't know. Speaking of, you already mentioned a movie you were thinking of reading the book. Maybe some kind of tips for people who got interested in this book now. Do you have any more apart from I'm a Cyborg, but that's okay?
Well, I think definitely people should read more I'm a Cyborg, but that's okay. see the movie, because it's really, it's a little bit underrated. Chan-wook Park is very famous for Old Boy and Lady Vengeance and lots of brutal films. And this is a comedy that he made, and it's really, really good. It's a really, really good comedy. And it's strange. It's a very strange comedy, but still. And I think I can highly recommend seeing the movie if it ever shows up on Netflix or something. And when it comes to books, I haven't read much South Korean literature. I'm a big fan also of, I think he's somebody who's a little bit close to what Han Kang tried in her novel, is the Japanese Nobel laureate Kensaburo Oe. He is very close in style, I think, especially to this part one of the book, this kind of confessional literature, and was what he was famous, or what he got famous for. He has written The Silent Scream, for example, is one of the, A Personal Experience is another book of his. And personally, I'm a big fan of a trilogy of books which he wrote, A Tree in Flames. No relation to Hong Kong's book.
It's, Flaming Trees?
Yeah, exactly. There could be, but it's very much a book about Japanese mysticism in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I like his style a lot. He is a very interesting writer who's always mixing surreal elements with real elements, and it makes a very interesting reading experience. Any suggestions that you have?
Well, as I already mentioned before, there were several movies I had to think of, or maybe directors, more or less, because this part of getting manipulated by a narrator or by a story, and at the end learning, I think in this book you learn it before, or not being able to get right and wrong any longer and feeling guilty yourself when you finished reading it or when you finished watching the movie is totally Lars von Trier. Basically every movie I ever saw of him more or less has this thing going on, and that led in my case so far that I stopped watching his movies because I got so angry in the cinema feeling manipulated like that. But that was something I had to think of. Also Michael Haneke, because of the kind of violence that is there and the being so very drastic, and also these characters that somehow you can't totally understand them. It's so this staying strange through the whole thing and an underlying violence going on where you can't really, or it not always, it breaks out. Well, by Haneke, probably it breaks out in every, not always. Well, so these are the two directors I had to think of reading it. And then what a lot of the reviews already mentioned is Kafka. So not only Metamorphosis, but also, is it called Metamorphosis? Die Verwandlung?
I don't know.
Well, I have to look it up. So basically the most famous story about Gregor Samsa waking up as a beetle. And the other story I didn't know before is called Hunger Artist, where someone starves to death.
What we, before we recorded this podcast, we of course talked about it a little bit, and what came out was that we were both, I think, very impressed with the book.
Absolutely.
It's really a very fascinating book. It's just 180 pages, I think,
something like that.
And it's for the kind of the journey it takes you on, the stuff that's being mentioned in there is really
dense. The richness, I think. So I read that already 1 year ago for the first time, and now rereading it and preparing for the podcast, it was like a treasure box, really. It was really, really great just to go into and finding all these different motives in there, and I loved reading it, so highly recommended.
Yes, definitely. So it's very interesting. She, I think, definitely a writer to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
She has also, I think, there's another book from her which is called The Human Something.
Trace.
Human Acts.
Oh, Human Acts.
I haven't read that one yet, but I read in some reviews that it is very close to the vegetarian, in at least in the kind of feel it has.
And also something from the past, right?
Yes, it's a little bit older than the vegetarian. It's, she has published it in Korea
before. Oh no, I thought the motive that something from the past haunts you and breaks out.
In the Human Acts, it's I think a massacre which happened in the early 1980s when South Korea was still a military dictatorship. So, and that is basically what is haunting the people in Human Acts. And of course, we can only guess at what is haunting the protagonist, the vegetarian, but it seems something that is very, a motive that is very common in the work of Han Kang.
Mm-hmm.
At least as she's still at the beginning of her career, I think she's in her 30s. Is it being mentioned somewhere? She's still relatively young, at least. She's not very old. So hopefully there will be more books by Han Kang, and maybe we are going to talk about her again.
Yes.
Then thank you for listening, and see you next time.
See you next time, or hear you next time.
Bye.
Bye.